Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Are America's top executives overpaid? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. With business leaders on trial and in prison, there's growing concern about executive compensation. American CEOs get more than 300 times the pay of an average worker. Some pay packages encourage decisions that are good for top executives, but bad for their companies. Golden parachutes, stock options, and free use of company jets are hidden away in proxy statements or not reported at all. On To the Point, we'll hear about the first new public disclosure rules in 14 years. Will CEOs reduce their demands? Will boards of directors insist on accountability? On Reporter's Notebook later on, new reports on prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Norman, I'll be back with To the Point. With CEOs getting 300 times more pay than their workers, the Securities and Exchange Commission is taking a new look at executive compensation. On To the Point, how do corporate leaders get so much money? Will greater disclosure put an end to hidden perks worth tens of millions of dollars? On Reporter's Notebook, after 4 years, more than half the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay have not been accused of hostile acts. First, this news update. In a Washington speech today, President Bush gave new details of an incident that he said illustrates multinational cooperation against terrorism. He said that a Southeast Asian country helped thwart a plot to attack Los Angeles.
In October 2001, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of the September the 11th attacks, had already set in motion a plan to have terrorist operatives hijack an airplane using shoe bombs to breach the cockpit door and fly the plane into the tallest building on the West Coast. We believe the intended target was Liberty Tower in Los Angeles, California.
The president misspoke in identifying the Liberty Tower. He meant the Library Tower, which has since been renamed the U.S. Bank Tower. Josh Myers, a staff reporter for the Los Angeles Times, he wrote about this incident back in October. Josh, good to have you back with us.
Hi, Warren.
You said in your October 8th story that this was a plot that had been discussed but never put into action. The president said today, as we just heard, that it had already been set in motion. Does this change your story?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it depends on what you mean by put in motion or disrupted. We had a lengthy briefing with the head of the White House counterterrorism shop, Fran Townsend, this morning after the president's speech. And essentially, it's the same thing we reported back in October. It just depends on how you describe it. What happened was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had decided to try to recruit a few people to fly a plane into the tallest building on the West Coast. The plot was disrupted in Indonesia and elsewhere in Southeast Asia in late 2001, early 2002, before it really got off the drawing board. Nevertheless, it was set in motion to some degree, and then it was thwarted by the arrest of some of these individuals.
The president, and I understand Fran Townsend as well, are saying that four operatives were hired, that they went and met Osama bin Laden. He apparently endorsed this idea. Again, I guess the question is, what does set in motion mean?
Right. That's a good point. I think what we had reported was that that the plot never really reached an operational stage, and I think that most counterterrorism experts would continue to agree with that. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was an extremely creative and energetic terrorist leader, and he had various plots in motion at any given time, potentially dozens of plotters trying to attack the United States in any number of ways, and this is one of them. There were other ones as well, including perhaps the Zacharias Moussaoui plot. So it's hard to tell exactly who was ever going to get into the United States and launch an attack and where it was. Fran Townsend today in our briefing said that they never found out a particular day or flight or even any of the details indicating that this was something that was becoming an operational plot. And so the details are all very sketchy. In fact, they weren't even sure if it was going to be the Library Tower. They just knew that it was going to be the tallest building on the West Coast. So, I think people are willing to give them credit for disrupting a plot. It just depends on, how far along
Again, Josh Meyer is a Los Angeles Times staff writer. Where is Harlan Sheikh Mohammed now?
That's a very good question. I've been trying to find the answer to that for some time, and Robert Mueller, the director of the FBI, even told me personally that he doesn't know where he is, and he said he doesn't want to know where he is, but very, very few people in the government do know where he is, and they're not talking.
He is in the custody, though, of U.S. authorities or some authority at this point?
I believe so, yes.
Did the president indicate, did Fran Townsend indicate, whether any of the information involved came from the controversial surveillance by the National Security Agency?
Well, we specifically asked her that, Warren, and she said that she cannot disclose sources and methods. She did say that, you know, that all means available to the United States government have been used and will continue to be used in disrupting terrorist plots. So she sort of hinted that that might be the case. She also went out of her way to say that the interrogation of detainees in custody went a long way towards helping disrupt this plot and others. And I think by that she means Khalid Sheikh Mohammed himself and Hambali, his chief aide in Southeast Asia, who was also arrested and was believed to be involved in this, that they discussed the plot and their interrogations with U.S. officials.
So there's really no indication at this point that Los Angeles was directly in the line of fire at any particular time.
Well, I think that, you know, Al-Qaeda has always been known for trying to revisit the location of failed attempts in the past. As we know, Ahmed Rassam, the Millennium Bomber, wanted to blow up some suitcase bombs at LAX, for instance, and that was unsuccessful. So they always try to go back to their targets. I mean, the World Trade Center was first targeted with a bomb in 1993, and they successfully took it down in 2001. So I think that, you know, it's always been on their wish list of targets, whether or not they ever get close to actually, you know, launching an attack to take it, you know, to fly a plane into it is another matter.
So one would assume then that Los Angeles is still on the wish list?
I think it is, and I know that authorities in Los Angeles as well as in Washington are very, very wary or very observant and trying to keep a lookout for potential plots because they know that they're, I guess, gunning for Los Angeles in a matter of speaking.
Josh Meyer, as always, thanks very much for being with us.
As always, you're very welcome.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. In a moment, are America's top executives paid too much money? On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. General Motors is in so much trouble it might go bankrupt. The so-called dream team of executives has not performed as promised back in 2001. In 2004, CEO Richard Wagoner made at least $4.6 million in salary and bonuses. Now there's no bonus, and he's cutting his own pay in half, down to $1.1 million. That's according to David Welch, Detroit bureau chief for Business Week magazine. Thanks a lot, David, for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Is this a mea culpa, or is Wagoner being punished in some way by the board of directors?
No, actually, it's sort of voluntary and sort of a nudge from Kirk Kerkorian, who's now one of their largest shareholders. What's really going on here is the UAW, the United Auto Workers Union, had agreed late in the year to a bunch of big concessions, among them cuts to retiree health care benefits, and they, of course, gave in on 30,000 jobs over the next few years. And while they were negotiating that, they asked for a kind of equity of sacrifice, or basically share the pain with us. And they wanted to see the salaried people, the shareholders, and the top execs take some of the heat as well. And then after that, in early January, Kerkorian's deputy, Jerry York, whose name you may recall from having been the CFO of IBM and Chrysler during their dark years, and for being Kerkorian's kind of point man on the while they were kind of negotiating with Chrysler in the mid to late 90s on either taking it over or getting some shareholder kickbacks then. He had made a speech in January suggesting that they should cut the dividend, they should cut executive pay and this sort of thing to show the union that it's really crisis time and that more cuts than they've already given may be necessary. So part of it is showing the union, and part of it is, look, you know, this is a company that lost $8.6 billion last year. And if they are asking for their dealers to cut their margins on the vehicles they sell and for the union to give, then they should probably give something to make it all even.
So as you said, it's sort of voluntary. There's nothing, I take it, in Wagoner's contract with the company that says if the company doesn't perform well, then he has to cut his salary.
No, but in fairness to GM, they're a lot of their executive pay, or a big chunk of it, has been kind of performance or bonus based for some time. Take 2004, when GM was last profitable. They made, I think, $3.5 or so billion, which for their size wasn't great, but it was a tidy little profit. And Wagoner's salary was $2.2 million, just like it was at the start of this year. And I think he made $2.4 million in bonuses, and then there were some other things with options and stock thrown on top of that. So you're talking about $4.6 million. That was erased last year because the company was losing so much money, and then this year they cut it in half.
With so many different kinds of compensation for various executives, do we know all that Mr. Wagoner makes?
Well, we have a pretty good idea. They have to file in the proxy, you know, what they get, and you know, they do get stock options and stock grants and that sort of thing, but GM stock is so low that a lot of that stuff is either underwater or, you know, you just can't exercise it and make any money off of it right now. So, you know, I think at least, you know, on first glance here, unless there are some retirement things or, you know, he were to leave the company or get fired and there were some severance deals, you know, I think we know what he's going to be making this year. And I think it's going to be $1.1 million plus. You know, there is some value to options even that are underwater, at least in terms of future value should the stock go up. But that's pretty much what he's going to make.
All right, David Welch, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Detroit Bureau Chief for Business Week magazine. Professor Jesse Fried is co-director at the Berkeley Center for Law, Business, and the Economy at the Bolt Hall School of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also co-author of Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. Professor Fried, thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Explain your title. It certainly speaks for itself, but elaborate a bit on what you mean.
Well, in our book, we find that a lot of the pay that public company executives get is not closely tied to their own contribution to firm value. And if you look at the pay that that the GM CEO has been receiving and the other top executives there, it's a perfect illustration of this problem. And basically, the pay is extremely performance insensitive. It's got a huge salary component, $2 million, which is much more than the typical salary of a public company executive. And there's a lot of value in the retirement plan. I think that if Wagoner were to retire now, he'd be getting over $1 million a year for the rest of his life. So his pension probably has an actuarial value of about $20 million. He's been getting bonuses, even though the company's stock price has dropped by about 70% over the last couple of years. With that type of structure, it's no wonder that he has not been working harder to try to serve shareholders and make the difficult decisions that have to be made in order to increase shareholder value. He's basically being paid like a bureaucrat, and he's running the company like a bureaucrat.
I suppose he might take issue with that, given what we heard about his efforts to get the UAW to make changes and all the rest of it. But I take it that your suggestion in Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation, is that this is typical of American companies?
Well, the problem in these public companies is that there's very little shareholder oversight of the board. The board is usually captured by management, and in negotiating compensation with management, it doesn't try very hard to serve shareholders' interests. It basically comes up with pay packages that are good for managers. And if you're a manager at a place like GM, where it's going to be very hard to get the stock price up and do well for shareholders, because it is a difficult business, then you're going to want to get paid a large salary. You're going to want to get a large pension. You're going to want to get paid a bonus even if you can't increase the stock price. And that's what Wagoner and the other executives there arranged for themselves, and that's what the board gave them.
Okay, Professor Jesse Fried, quickly back to David Welch, again in Detroit for Business Week magazine. My understanding that Mr. Wagoner's not getting a bonus this year. Is that right?
No, he's not. They get no bonuses. They didn't last year either. They're down to salary, and they've cut that.
So in that respect, then, there is a performance aspect to the deal that they have with the board at GM.
That's right, but keep in mind, when we talk about performance, you know, a good point was made that it's not tied to the stock because the stock has been stock's been battered in the past year and was going down before that. They tie it to things like quality and productivity gains and plant efficiency, market share, and that sort of thing. And that's why GM gained a little bit of market share from 2000 through about 2002, 2003. So bonuses were being paid out, and they were pretty rich bonuses for a company that was about to head into a pretty big tailspin.
Back to Professor Fried. You said that many executives are paid like bureaucrats and not for performance, and that they actually run the companies like bureaucrats. Why is that? And elaborate a bit, if you will, on why it is that boards of directors would hire people and pay them enormous amounts of money if it's not good for the company.
Well, you have to keep in mind that the board has very little at stake financially in the executive's pay arrangement because they own such a small fraction of the company's stock. These are people with very busy day jobs. They come in a couple of times a year to sit on board meetings, and they don't really have that much incentive to try to get the pay right. In addition, if they're interested in continuing to serve on the board, the key to remaining on the board is being renominated by the nominating committee, because basically in America, boards renominate themselves. Most director elections are not contested. And so even if there's a person on the board who is sort of troubled by executive pay practices, it's very risky for them personally to criticize the pay arrangements because they might find themselves not renominated to the board or not invited to other boards. So the boards are not serving shareholders adequately.
Why do they want to be on the boards?
Being on a board pays well. There are a lot of perks, and it's very useful for making valuable social and business connections.
So I take it then that the boards can be easily hornswoggled by the people that represent these executives?
Yeah, the boards are basically nominated by the management, chosen and nominated by the management themselves. And they have very little incentive to pay attention to what's good for shareholders because the likelihood that they will be thrown out by the shareholders is very slim, given that most board elections are not contested. And the reason why most are not contested is that it's extremely expensive to launch a proxy contest against a public company.
Professor Jesse Fried, again at UC Berkeley, author of Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. Our next guest is Joseph Batchelder. He's an attorney who negotiates CEO contracts. He's represented a lot of very high-profile executives, including Dennis Kozlowski, who was, of course, the former CEO of Tyco International. Mr. Batchelder, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
What do you say to what we just heard from Professor Fried, that the boards of directors are, in effect, a pushover for people like you?
Well, I think that boards of directors are spending far less time in connection with a particular company than does the CEO. Their opportunity to acquire knowledge about the company and about particular compensation plans and what is appropriate in a given case is in a parameter of time far less than the full-time management of a company. That time factor is very important, but I don't think it reflects on the efforts of most directors of most major corporations trying to do a good job and exercise good faith in their responsibilities.
Well, you've negotiated some pretty significant contracts, including that of Mr. Kozlowski. He, of course, has become famous for $6,000 curtains in his, I think, $30 million apartment in New York, all paid for by the company. How were those things good for Tyco?
Well, I did not represent Mr. Kozlowski in the negotiation of his contract.
Ah.
I advised him in connection with the proceedings that involved his being tried by a court in New York. I was advising as to the nature of his compensation plans and other arrangements, and I did not negotiate his contract.
Thank you for clarifying that. What do you say, though, to the question, and to not just his, but other CEO contracts, which allegedly include use of the company jet at high expense, living in gated communities at big expense to the corporation, all the things that we have heard about so many times. How often are these part of contracts, and why do they work to the benefit of the shareholders and the health of the company?
Well, in a way, it boils down to money, doesn't it? Whether it's in one form or another. And if a competitive market is establishing an overall price to a position, then whether it's paid in salary or bonus or long-term incentives, it is not something that is decided in isolation. A chief executive officer has, generally speaking, a price range that's relevant to that position due to a lot of factors, not just what others are paid, but also the needs of the company, his own capabilities, and his experience. Let me give you an example of a case where a lot of money was paid and a lot of value was delivered. Jack Welch at General Electric, criticized for some of the perquisites at the end of his career, as you have noted, nonetheless delivered $300 billion increase in General Electric's market capitalization. 20 years of Jack Welch and all that increase in market cap cost the shareholders of General Electric roughly 10 cents per share. When it comes to CEOs, I would say let's not be penny wise and pound foolish. Careful. Exercising good faith, but I think in many instances, the wringing of hands over our CEO compensation in this country is a bit more than is really deserved by the system as a whole.
Joseph Batchelder, again, negotiates a high-profile executive contract, not always high-profile, but big executive contracts for corporate executives. Back to Professor Reed, again, author of Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. 10 cents per share, the cost of Jack Welch, even though, as pointed out, at the end of his career, we learned about a lot of perks that we didn't know about before. What's wrong with that?
You know, if every CEO were like Jack Welch, I would have no problem with executive compensation in the United States. The problem is that Jack Welch is probably an exception to the rule, and the rule is that in most cases companies are overpaying their executives and not paying them well. The fact that among 15,000 companies you can find one where you had an exceptional CEO, and of course there's probably more than one, who delivered much more value than, you know, what he was paid, doesn't prove that there's no problem in the system.
Okay. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment with Professor Fried, Joseph Batchelder, and others as well. On Reporter's Notebook later, we'll talk about new reports on the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, talking today about executive compensation. Is it too high? Are corporations led by boards of directors getting what they pay for? Are the shareholders being served by executives who earn what appears to be, to many of the rest of us, very, very high salaries? Back to Professor Fried at Berkeley, author of Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. Whatever you think about Jack Welch, his perks were not, in fact, known in detail until there was widespread publicity because of a divorce settlement, and it was out of that that these things were revealed. There have been a lot of concerns about the fact that many of the kinds of perks we're talking about aren't made public, aren't part of the proxy statements. The shareholders don't know about them, and that appears to have been the case with GE. Now the SEC is calling for more disclosure. Professor Fried, is that going to help?
Yes. The SEC is planning to tighten disclosure requirements around compensation, and in particular, for the first time, they're going to require that companies place a dollar value on equity-based compensation and the increase in value of retirement benefits, and then provide a a total compensation amount. What happened is that in the early 1990s, the SEC came up with advanced disclosure requirements for executive compensation, but over the last 15 years, compensation plan designers have figured out ways of providing compensation to executives, including through very extensive retirement programs and perks, in ways that are not reflected clearly in the format that the SEC developed in the early 1990s. So now the SEC is sort of catching up with practice and trying to close some of the loopholes. And so as a result, shareholders will get a much clearer picture of what executives are being paid.
Back to Joseph Batchelder, an attorney who negotiates contracts for CEOs and other executives. Is that a good idea?
Certainly disclosure, transparency is a good idea, but I think we're making a mistake if we think it's going to significantly affect the progress of executive pay in this country. In 1992, as Professor Fried notes, the SEC added rules that expanded the disclosure of executive pay, and as we know, in the 90s and into the 21st century, executive pay went through an enormous growth. And I don't think that whether it's the stock market or the executive or CEO pay market, that the increasing disclosure is going to affect the natural forces in the market that are determining what the price of a CEO is, just like the price of a share of stock.
Joseph Batchelder, again, a negotiator of contracts. Brandon Rees is our next guest. He's Assistant Director of the Office of Investment at the AFL-CIO, worked with union-sponsored pension plans to improve corporate governance. Brandon Rees, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
You've looked very closely at all of this, and let me ask you, is there any relationship between the high pay of executives, according to your research, and the performance of companies? Do the companies with the highest paid executives do the best?
Well, the problem with runaway CEO pay is that every extra dollar in excessive compensation comes at the direct cost of shareholders, and that includes the retirement savings of America's working families. And the problem is that there is not a direct connection between CEO pay and company performance, and this has been well documented by academic researchers like Professor Fried. And the problem is that that directors and particularly board compensation committees are too close for comfort when it comes time to setting the CEO pay, and that's a direct result because of the way directors are picked in this country. It's a self-perpetuating system. And is why we need director election reform in the selection of who sits on these compensation committees.
So you would go there then, rather than just to disclosure, as now being called for by the SEC?
That's right. Disclosure is a necessary reform, but it's not sufficient to fixing the executive compensation system and making it more accountable to shareholders.
Well, what about the example of Jack Welch, and aren't there others like him who, even though they appear to be getting a lot of money compared to the workers in the company, in fact, are worth, in his case, 10 cents a share, in others perhaps, maybe they said the ratio isn't that good, but why would boards of directors continue to do this if they weren't getting something?
Well, the problem is that excessive compensation has two direct costs to shareholders. One, and the largest, is through stock option compensation. Total potential dilution from stock options, according to the Investor Responsibility Research Center, is at an all-time record high of 17%. And the lion's shares of those stock options are going to senior executives of companies. So shareholders are having their ownership stake of companies diluted. And then the second point I would make is that excessive executive compensation is a red flag to a corporate to a power imbalance in corporate boardrooms. Every corporate accounting scandal that we've seen at Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, and others was preceded by excessive executive pay, particularly for the CEO-level position.
So you think then that there is a correlation between what you refer to as excessive pay and problems with the company?
That's exactly right. And we believe that that the way you address the problem is through director election reform, particularly by empowering shareholders to nominate their own directors in what's known as equal access to the proxy, and also requiring that directors be elected by majority votes. The irony is that directors who are nominated by company insiders under the current system can be reelected by just receiving just one vote, even if a majority of shareholders withhold their support for that director, because we do not have competitive elections in which dissidents can mount effective proxy fights.
Brandon Reese, again with the AFL-CIO. I want to go back to the question of the idea of shareholder election reform. But before I do that, though, let me ask Joseph Batchelder about a couple of specifics. Reading now from the current New Yorker magazine, James Surowiecki has a column there where he says this: golden parachutes that guarantee executives huge payoffs if their companies are acquired may encourage them to sell out, even when the company would be better off remaining independent. He says highly paid executives are more likely than their peers to make acquisitions and receive major financial rewards for doing that, even when the acquisition ends up destroying corporate value. How do you control that kind of thing?
Well, you control it by having appropriate leadership. It's not a compensation matter per se. In the 1980s, there was concern that management was trying to keep itself in power and resisting restructuring, taking over of companies in order to keep itself in power. Now we have what this gentleman is saying is the reverse. Executives that are encouraged to go through the process of mergers and acquisitions because they have parachute contracts. My own feeling, I think we're putting the cart before the horse. I think the basic corporate strategy and fundamentals of leadership are involved, and that compensation is not the primary force in that particular issue.
Do you negotiate for those things, though? Do you try to get golden parachutes and try to get incentives for acquisitions or the kinds of things we're talking about that can be abused?
Well, I think, yes, I do. I do. And I think that in part, the corporate governance benefit is that within reasonable parameters, it means that senior management is freed from the concern that if the company is taken over, they may lose their job.
And why should they be free from that concern?
Well, because in making a decision whether or not to merge or be acquired, their own pocketbook, so to speak, the damage to it, to their career, should not be a primary factor. And what parachutes do is to eliminate that as a negative in determining whether or not there will be a restructuring of the company.
Brandon Rees, back to you with the AFL-CIO. How do you feel about golden parachutes?
Well, I would disagree. Golden parachutes can provide an incentive for mergers that are not in the long-term interests of shareholders of the company. They also reduce the premium that shareholders of the company receive. And you see some of the most egregious examples of golden parachutes rewarding executives who have poorly performed leading up to the sale of the company. And a perfect example of that is at Delphi. Delphi is a company that was spun off from General Motors. It's now in bankruptcy. The company is trying to shed its pension obligations. And at the same time, the executives are petitioning the bankruptcy court for the largest executive bankruptcy bonus plan, which was to include a severance benefit if all the executives were terminated of $145 million. This is the same executives who led the company into bankruptcy, which included, by the way, accounting fraud leading up to the company's downfall.
Mr. Batchelder, what about the protection of shareholders and protection of workers who have pensions in the companies, not to mention jobs at stake? To what extent is that a concern when you negotiate for an executive with the board of directors?
I don't think that the pay of a chief executive officer or other senior executive is going to determine whether or not the pension of the worker or the SERPs of the, that is, supplemental retirement plans of middle-level executives, are going to be adversely affected. The amounts of salary and bonus paid to chief executive officers has little to do with the tragic results in a case like Enron. It wasn't compensation. It was something else, more fundamental. Compensation is a product and a victim of our system, but it is not the cause of the problem.
Obviously, a lot of ways to look at this. Back to Professor Jesse Fried at Berkeley, co-author, once again, of Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. What about Brandon Rees' suggestion that what we need is a change in the way that directors are chosen? Would shareholders, do you think, be more responsible if they had a more direct way of choosing directors? Do they really have the knowledge for that?
I think Brandon is absolutely right. At the end of the day, increasing disclosure, while beneficial, is going to have only limited impact. What we need are boards that are more focused on shareholder interests. And the way to get boards that are more focused on shareholder interest is to increase the likelihood that individual directors can be replaced through shareholder votes. Right now, it's extremely difficult for the reasons that Brandon said. Basically, under corporate and securities law, even if only one person votes in favor of a director, as long as it's not a contested election, that director can keep their position. So I would definitely be in favor of making it easier for shareholders to remove individual directors or the entire board. I think steps in that direction will cause boards to be more concerned about how their decisions affect shareholders and how the executive compensation arrangements they negotiate affect shareholders and will lead to better executive compensation.
Brandon Rees with the AFL-CIO, this was your suggestion. Wouldn't this give enormous power to the biggest shareholders? Presumably a vote would be proportional to the amount of shares that anybody held. Are their interests always the same as those of the rank and file?
Well, I think what we need is accountability in corporate boardrooms. And accountability, and particularly with the CEO, is critical to all stakeholders in the company. Be that employees, shareholders, or company's customers. And Enron is a perfect case in point. CEO pay and stock option compensation in particular was the incentive for the accounting manipulation that we saw at Enron. Enron insiders cashed out over $1 billion in equity compensation made possible by their fraudulent accounting. That is a fact that that cannot be understated. That excessive pay and poorly structured CEO compensation plans can have real impact not just on company performance, but on workers' retirement savings and their jobs.
Mr. Batchelder, would it have been more difficult for you to negotiate with boards for golden parachutes, stock options, and all the rest if the directors were looking over their shoulders at stockholders who would have a major voice in deciding whether they kept their jobs?
Well, I think that the stockholder role in today's environment is affected by the fact that the average institutional shareholder holds a share of stock on the New York Stock Exchange for about 11 months. It is really a problem as to identifying who is the shareholder, as suggested by your own question. I think that the problem, again, is not with identifying with a particular shareholder or shareholder group, but in the quality and attention given to the leadership of our companies. It's qualitative as much as systemic.
Let me just ask you one more question, Mr. Batchelder. There's a study, according again to the New Yorker and James Sirwicki's column, that the indicates, this is by Rutgers and Penn State, indicating that the more a CEO was paid relative to his peers, the more likely his company was to underperform in the stock market. Have you seen that study? Do you agree with that statement?
Well, I don't think that there is probably that much correlation. It depends on how you define compensation. Was it looking at, I do not know whether that study looked at salary, bonus, long-term incentives, and what industries were involved. I do believe, again, that the performance of a company is one thing. Compensation is another. I think compensation of executives is as much a result and the product of negotiation as it is a driving factor in the success of the company. The success of the company is the paramount objective, but I do not think executive compensation is the primary factor in the Enron's and WorldCom's problems. Those were fundamental flaws in corporate governance, including fraud, but not because of a systemic or idiosyncratic failure in the compensation at particular companies.
And Professor Fried, we haven't heard from you on that issue as yet. What do you think?
Well, I think there are problems in executive compensation that created the environment for these scandals. And I'm thinking about the fact that CEOs who are paid in stock are basically allowed to unwind their positions at will once the stock is vested, which means that they have an incentive to manipulate short-term earnings right before they unload a lot of their stock. If in their compensation agreements they were forced to hold stock for the long term, and if their bonuses were not based on short-term earnings, which are easily manipulable, then they would not be spending a lot of time trying to manipulate short-term earnings to get the stock price up in the short term with disastrous consequences for the long term. So I do think there is a connection, and studies have shown that there is such a connection between the structure of executive compensation and these accounting scandals. With respect to those particular companies, there may have been other things that were going wrong as well. But in general, if you look across all the accounting scandals in U.S. public companies, you see that there's a very strong correlation between accounting restatements and the ability of executives to unwind their stock compensation.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for joining us. The SEC, once again, is taking a look at new disclosure requirements. We'll see what else they look at and whether they consider Brandon Rees' proposal, and seconded by Professor Fried, for different ways of choosing directors. I want to thank all of you for being with us. Again, Brandon Rees with the AFL-CIO, Professor Jesse Fried at UC Berkeley, and Joseph Batchelder, a negotiator of CEO contracts. Good to have all of you with us. Look forward to talking to you again. Today's New York Times reports that officials at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, are using tougher measures to force-feed detainees who go on hunger strikes, apparently with the intention of committing suicide. Yesterday, lawyers for some of the detainees reported that half the 500 prisoners there have not been accused of committing hostile acts against the U.S. or its allies. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Manali back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Today's New York Times story on Guantanamo Bay says that prisoners on hunger strikes are being kept in restraint chairs, sometimes for hours a day, to prevent them from vomiting after they've been force-fed. Lawyers for some of the detainees call that brutal and inhumane. Military officials insist they can't morally allow people to kill themselves. Meantime, a team of law students at Seton Hall University in New Jersey has studied public records to determine what charges have been made against inmates who've been at Guantanamo Bay for more than 4 years. Mark Denbow is a law professor at Seton Hall. His son Joshua is a lawyer who represents two Tunisian detainees. Joshua Denbow, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about the findings of this student group about the charges or non-charges against the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay?
Well, the report was prepared by Mark, my father, and I. The students were integral to preparing all the data. We could not have done it without them. What I can tell you about the report is that this is the first report that's been done using the government's own words and own data. The government produced, as a result of the Combatant Status Review Tribunal, certain pieces of information used at that tribunal to defend its conclusion that every single one of the prisoners was, in fact, an enemy combatant. And what we did is we looked at all the CSRT summaries to see what the government actually said regarding these prisoners and found out some very surprising facts. One that startled me the most was that of all the prisoners caught out in Afghanistan and other places, only 5% were caught by U.S. forces. And that raises the specter to me, the fact that for at least 95% of these guys in Guantanamo, I don't see how anybody, the government or their attorneys, can ever check or verify the accuracy of the information that was provided to us that started the process for the government claiming that they are enemy combatants.
Well, who picked them up? If, for example, it was British authorities, wouldn't you be able to check with them?
Yes, you would. But the problem is it wasn't British authorities. A significant percentage of the detainees who were picked up by Pakistani authorities. Now, they were also picked up at around the same time as the government, our government, was issuing bounty promises for anybody who turned in, anybody associated with a whole list of supposedly unlawful or terroristic organizations. Now, the government in their data shows that over 44% of the prisoners, they don't have data for who was produced by them. For the remainder, there's approximately 30% were picked up by Pakistan. I don't understand what support the government can provide in its detailed information to support the claim that they're enemy combatants if they can't test the person who produced this person in exchange for money to the United States authorities on the claim that they are an improper person.
And I take it there's nothing in the public record to answer your question.
Well, the question being, no, there is absolutely nothing in the public record to answer the question of what was told to the United States government when they were produced by people, by bounty hunters, 4 years ago now.
What is some of the evidence against them? Or are any of them charged with hostile acts?
Well, certainly there are some people in here who are charged with hostile acts, with some pretty terrible acts that they allegedly did. The problem we have is that there are certainly other people who are charged with almost no hostile acts whatsoever. In fact, charged with almost nothing, and yet they also remain in Guantanamo. If I could read an example, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Okay. Under this, we don't know who this is because the data we have is anonymous in the sense that we have the data for all the 517 prisoners, but we don't know whose data applies to which prisoner. So I'm going to read from a CSRT summary, not knowing who this prisoner is, just knowing this is the government's data. The government concludes that the detainee is associated with the Taliban because, quote, the detainee indicates that he was conscripted into the Taliban. That's all the government says. An unwilling association with the Taliban doesn't seem sufficient to me to declare that this person is an enemy combatant. Government also goes on to contend that the detainee engaged in hostilities against the U.S. or its coalition partners. And its evidence of that, or proof of that, was that, one, the detainee admits that he was a cook's assistant for Taliban forces in Afghanistan under the command of somebody. And two, the detainee fled to Kabul during the Northern Alliance attack and surrendered to the Northern Alliance. And that is the sum total of all the proofs the government has against this detainee to claim that he's an enemy combatant.
One of the news reports I've seen about your report is that in some case the allegation was that somebody had used a guest house or wore olive drab clothing. Is that correct?
Yes. There are four pieces of proof that I found interesting in a disturbing sort of way. One of them was the use of the guest house. Another was that he wore olive drab clothing. Another is that he wore a Casio watch, and that was, I don't know why that's evidence of anything. And the last is that, I lost my train of thought, but those are three of the ones that indicated to me a problem. Obviously, people wearing a watch does not indicate much of anything, at least not to me.
How many of the people are charged with what you describe as a terrible acts?
Well, I don't know about the terrible act, but there's 11 people for whose CSRT summary indicates a personal connection to Osama bin Laden. Obviously, people who have given a sworn an oath to Osama bin Laden probably are an enemy combatant, whatever that actually means.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is not the people who actually are the worst of the worst, as Donald Rumsfeld called everybody there. My problem is that we don't know really anything about anybody there. And I think our analysis of the government's data makes clear why the government has tried so hard for 4 years to prevent any hearings on any of the proofs against these prisoners.
Why? What's the point? If, in fact, all they've done is wear a Casio watch or olive drab clothing, what's the point of having them there? Do you have any indication from the government about that at all?
There's nothing in the CSRT summaries to explain that.
All right. Obviously, this is one that we'll keep coming back, and we'll hear more about it as time goes on. Joshua Denbo, that's all the time we have right now. Again, a New Jersey attorney representing a couple of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. I understand you can't talk about what you have seen or observed at Guantanamo Bay yourself, and let me just let our listeners know that's why I haven't asked you directly about that. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Today's program produced by Jonah King with Cameron Radziner and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.